Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
What's up, Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. All our guests appear via the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Busy guest list for you today. At 10:15, PJ Carlissimo will stop by, ESPN NBA analyst, longtime coach, coached in the Final Four in college, and obviously, as I mentioned, an NBA coach for many years, and was part of Chuck Daly's staff on the Dream Team. So we're going to talk to PJ about the Jordan era, coaching against Jordan, coaching with Jordan, right? Coaching Jordan on that Dream Team as he was part of that Chuck Daly original Dream Team staff. And then at 10:40, Michael Cooper will stop by. We'll do a little story time with Coop. And 11:30, Charles Barkley. So we've got an action-packed show for you today. And, of course, it's brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless, where they don't play any games, man. Get the unlimited plan with 25 gigs of high-speed data and 2G for $45 a month, saving you half the cost of big carriers. No contracts, no compromise. Savings may vary. See terms and conditions at straighttalk.com. So I found myself, and I'm sure a lot of you felt the same way, as I watched The Last Dance yesterday, with a bit of mixed emotions. It was cool to see Kobe at the beginning of it, and they did it in honor of Kobe Bryant at the beginning, and just the interaction between him and Jordan as a young player, but just watching Kobe on camera. And Greg, I'm going to come right to you today. Watching Kobe on camera, I would imagine, had just a bunch of feelings and emotions running through you, because it did for me. And you grew up a lifelong Laker fan. And grew up here in LA. Like, I would imagine, I'm just someone who loves basketball and appreciated him for who he is, and really understands what he meant to this city, specifically after he passed away. It was just incredible, the outpouring. It was hard to not really notice it when you were around, especially where we work. But for you, I would imagine, if it was weird and tough for me and also kind of cool all wrapped into one, I would imagine for you it was a little odd too.
Yeah, it was tough. It was a lot harder than I knew it was going to be hard for me. But then when it actually started happening, I was like, oh man, this is, because you saw young Kobe like going up against Jordan in the All-Star game. And then you saw old Kobe, or not even old, just Kobe that you know him as now, kind of. And so you're just like, oh God, why this is, it was just hard to see him like that. In both ways, it was just tough. It was hard for those few minutes that he was on.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome, though, what he was saying there. You know, talking about how what Michael meant to him, talking about how there's no five championships here, as in LA, if it wasn't for the way basically Michael took him under his wing.
Oh, yeah. No, that stuff was really cool. No champ, no five without him. And then I really liked when they were in the locker room and Jordan was calling him that little Laker boy. And then Grant Hill on the bench, like, I'm not getting in his way. I'm not going to let him put me on a poster. That stuff was all pretty cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty wild. You know what I'm saying? Like, and just some of the things he talked about, right? Like the quotes about where it was a rough couple of years for me coming to the league, because at the time the league was so much older. I was a kid that shot a bunch of air balls, and that at that point Michael provided a lot of guidance for me. And it is incredible, because in this day and age, and we talked about this a little bit during the memorial, which is, you know, we were kind of surprised, right, by their relationship. And I think that knowing now from both sides, because now we've now heard it from both sides, what that relationship was like and how Michael guided him, I almost feel like it was strange that we didn't know beforehand, right? That never really got out, that Kobe never really talked about it, and clearly Michael didn't talk about it, and just how important those two were to each other.
Yeah, it was interesting that they would not let that be known. I mean, you would think that they wanted to keep it secret for whatever reason. I just really liked that he was talking, Kobe was sitting there talking about how much he meant to him, was that he would ask him during an All-Star game, like, how he does his turnaround jumper the correct way so he can work on that in 1998. It's pretty intense how close they actually were.
Yeah, and Kobe talked about that specific All-Star game. He says, I grew up watching Michael on TV, and now I got a chance to go face-to-face with him. You get that chance to really see and touch and feel the strength, speed, and quickness. It was fun to be out there. I mean, it just was an incredible thing to watch. You know what I'm saying? Like, and as you mentioned, he said he was like my big brother. I don't get the five championships here without him because he guided me so much and gave me so much great advice. It is awesome to see that. And didn't you get the sense that later in Kobe's career, he kind of did some of that too, where he was, he did talk about that it was tough for him at first because he was so much younger than everyone else. But as he got older, he kind of really embraced being one of the elder statesmen of the league.
Yeah, he really did. He was over and over again. He would have, you know, he would work out with Giannis afterward during the off season. He would work out with whoever wanted him. Kyle Kuzma was somebody that worked out with him. So he really actually put himself out there to be with people. And that it really could have switched. I mean, if Jordan didn't actually do that for him, he may never have done it for anybody else because, like, oh, look, Jordan didn't do it for me. I got to do it all on my own. You guys got to do it on your own. And he didn't do that. It's great to actually see that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us in any walk of life, right, like can relate to that in some way, shape, or form. You don't have to be a professional basketball player. There's someone in your industry, whatever it is you do, right, whatever you do for a living, whatever you do as a hobby, that you know in your life or that you were able to cross paths with in your life that was able to impart wisdom to you because they went through whatever you're going through first. And I think that all those things, right, because, you know, neither guy, Jordan or Kobe, you know, had an easy go of any of it, right, whether it was on the floor, off the floor. Like, there were a lot of things that happened in their lives that they had to manage. And they were able to get out of the other side of it, right? Regardless of whether it was on or off the court. And I think that in life, we've all, I would hope that most of us at least have that person in our life, whether it's a family member, a friend, a neighbor, a cousin, an uncle, a grandmother, you know, a friend of the family, someone or someone at work that you've come across or growing up, you know, playing sports or at school, like someone that has been able to impart wisdom. I think everybody's got someone like that. And I think that it's really relatable. And it's honestly what I think makes Kobe even more fascinating than Jordan is that we talked about this, you know, at the time when he passed about how the Mamba mentality is not just a thing for Kobe and athletes. Like, it clearly is. But I feel like here in LA, people embrace that as kind of their own mantra, kind of attacking the day and attacking their own lives in a similar way.
Yeah, the Mamba mentality is a real thing. And that's most people here in LA try and live by it to some sort of way, one way or another. And I mean, I know I have. And that, you know, I'm sure you're talking a lot about how having the mentor. I'm sure you've been in this business for, I don't know how long, a long time.
20 years, 20 years, more than 20 years now.
Yeah, more than 20 years now. I'm sure when you were first coming up, there was somebody that you got some wisdom from that you still, maybe still talk to today. I mean, I know that I did when I first got into the business. I, you know, 18 years old, I started early and I got wisdom right off the bat from people and led me to where I am today. It's everybody needs that.
Yeah, for sure. Laura, how did you feel when you saw Kobe on the screen? Was it something that was emotional?
100%. My car's name is Kobe, so I broke down.
Wow.
Yeah, once I saw him, it was a wrap. And then I was kind of drinking, so I was like, that's not a good combination.
Yeah.
I lost it. My mom's like, what happened? And she's like, oh, Kobe's on the screen.
Yeah.
I'll give you your time.
Yeah, that's tough. I get it. Like, I totally get it. And I would imagine a lot of people felt that way. I'd be curious to hear from the audience at 877-710-ESPN, 877-710-3776, and kind of get their thoughts on what it was like for them watching Kobe on that screen. You know, it's only been a few months, and I think just dealing with all of that certainly had to be emotional for everyone. So I'd love to hear from you, and we can just kind of share together here. In the interim, Michael Wilbon was on SportsCenter last night with Scott Van Pelt and shared a story about talking to Kobe, specifically about Michael. Let's hear Michael Wilbon.
Kobe called him all the time. Each one of those guys, they were worried that people outside looking in would take it the wrong way, just going after each other a little bit. I remember a night when I was waiting outside the Laker locker room and Kobe had some great game where he had like 45 and, you know, 9 rebounds and whatever. And as he walked in the locker room, I got an elbow and Kobe said, what would your boy have done tonight? And he would laugh. And I said, will you let me write about this? And he said, no, nobody's going to understand it. And it was such joy that this was going to get back to Michael. And that relationship was closer, I think, than anybody understood until at the memorial when Michael had the reaction he did and told the story about Kobe being a nuisance to a point as a little brother. There was such fondness on a daily basis there for years.
You know what's cool about that story is that he told that story here a month ago. That was the story when I asked Michael about their relationship that he told on this particular story. So that I thought it'd be cool to kind of resurface here because he's right. Like Kobe was still competitive with Michael, even though Michael wasn't even playing at that time, which is pretty awesome when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, he had a huge respect for Michael Jordan, and it was really cool. Like to know that he wanted that sixth ring so he could tie Michael or even get to seven at some point. Everything was always to be, and he talked about it a ton too, about how without Jordan, there's no me, and I learned so much from him. He's like, everything that you see on the floor, that's Jordan. That's through Jordan.
Yeah, for sure. Now, the great Jackie McMullen was also on with Michael Wilbon and Scott Van Pelt on SportsCenter and talked about the relationship between Jordan and a young Kobe Bryant. Let's hear Jackie real quick.
So he was going to talk trash to Kobe and try to beat him. But afterwards, what does he say to him? Hey, kid, call me anytime. And Kobe did. In fact, during the lockout shortened season, the 98-99 season, when they weren't playing, he called and spent an hour on the phone talking to Jordan about how to body up against bigger defenders, bigger, stronger guards. He was having trouble with that. And that started almost a two-decade-long correspondence because all Kobe wanted to be was Michael. And Michael didn't mind it. He saw a lot of himself in Kobe.
Yeah, I could totally see that. Like, it's like we were just talking about. If somebody opens the door for you, you're going right in, especially if it's someone that you looked up to. Like, you're doing that a million times over.
Absolutely.
Excellent drop in, Greg. That's why you're the best in the business. I mean, for the love of God, that's all you got.
No, I was doing multiple things at once.
Go ahead. Tell us what you were doing. I want the audience to know what you were doing. Go ahead.
Okay, if you want to know everything that was going on, I'm listening, but I'm also trying to do – I'm writing the rundown in the way that it's supposed to be written now because it has to be written differently than it was before. Talking to Amanda about an idea that we have for the station and listening to the show.
I mean, you literally just said you paused for like 3 seconds and then said absolutely. That's all you gave me there.
I was hoping you were just going to keep going.
Oh, for the love of God. Anyway, real quick, one last thing. We'll get to more on Kobe and Michael's relationship. But episode 5 was by far my favorite. It was my favorite. And the other thing was, and this is what I want to talk to PJ Carlissimo about in the next couple of minutes, because I always love just talking to PJ anyway, because he's got some of the best stories, because he's been around for so long, that the Dream Team, what they didn't show in that movie yesterday, which they showed in the Dream Team documentary, which is a separate documentary, was the Dream Team played a game before that infamous game that Magic was talking about yesterday in the Jordan doc. And it was a game against the college kids where the college kids beat them. Bobby Hurley and those guys and Chris Webber came in and beat them because the guys were out there partying in Monte Carlo and they weren't taking the game all that serious. And all of a sudden, you know, Chuck Daly was calling the game tight on purpose to give the kids a little bit of an edge. And they ended up beating them. And it kind of grabbed their attention. So there's just a lot of those stories that weren't even in the documentary that we could talk to PJ about. Because the Dream Team is really what made basketball explode, right? Larry and Michael put the game on the map because we were talking about the finals being on in tape delay. It would come on after the local news back before Larry and Magic. And then Michael took it to a different stratosphere. Obviously, it became more global. But the Dream Team, they took it beyond to different the galaxy, basically. Like, they covered the gamut. There was no inch of the world where those guys weren't known, particularly Michael, because of the way the Dream Team represented basketball at those Olympics. So there's got to be a million stories to talk about. Obviously, PJ coached against Michael too, and that that era. So we'll talk to our friend PJ Carlissimo, ESPN NBA analyst, calls games with me and the crew on ESPN television and ESPN radio. We'll talk to him in just a second. PJ Carlissimo coming up in 4 minutes. Michael Cooper at 10:40. Charles Barkley at 11:30. Sedano, 710 ESPN. Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN. Presented by Progressive Insurance. Progressive's Home Quote Explorers, changing the way you buy home insurance. Now you can get an online quote, get a custom quote, save both time and money. Learn more at progressive.com. PJ Carlissimo will join us here in just a second. Charles Barkley at 11:30. Michael Cooper in between at 10:40. So we got a busy show for you today. A lot of guests, some great guests. We'll talk Dream Team and Facing Jordan with PJ in a second. He'll give us the Straight Talk, brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. Everything for less. And of course, no contract, no compromise. The aforementioned PJ Carlissimo, friend of the program, joining us here. We want to talk Jordan with him, talk Dream Team with him, and just kind of catch up. PJ, how you feeling, man? Everybody good?
Excellent, George. Things have quieted a little bit up here in Seattle. We kind of started a week ahead of everybody, and we're used to it. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. But it's things are good. The family's good. Appreciate it. Hope your family's well.
All good here, brother. Good to hear from you, too, obviously. So, PJ, obviously the entire world is focused in on this Jordan documentary, The Last Dance. And look, you know plenty about this. You played against those teams, or excuse me, you coached against those teams, you know, with the Blazers and, you know, when you were with the Warriors. What was it like competing against that group?
It was no fun. The problem... somebody made the point last night, I think it was Steve Kerr, I'm not sure, made the point they were under, kind of like the Lakers this year, and hopefully when they get back to it, underrated defensively. You know, everybody talks about the Lakers, how well they've played all year, and I think probably the thing that Frank and the team have done the best, they're so good defensively, which a lot of people, I think, don't appreciate. The Bulls, I mean, start with, they had arguably the two best perimeter defenders in the league, and Scottie Pippen and Michael. And then, you know, Phil is an excellent defensive coach. They really, really defended well. It was hard to run offense against them, and that kind of got them out and running. You know, so many of the clips you're watching, even in these first six segments, are fast break clips. Michael and Scottie, like, you know, going down, open floor, dunking. Tony Kukoc had a beautiful, like, kind of lefty behind the back pass the other day. It was hard to run offense against them, particularly because you couldn't enter the ball on the wing when those two guys were, Scottie was always engaged. I don't say Michael picked and chose, but like, if you had a really good player, Michael would just try and take him out of the game. And it was unbelievable. So like, before you even could worry about defending the triangle offense. I mean, they were a really good half-court execution team, but the biggest problem was the transition defense. They'd be running down your throat all the time because they forced turnovers, and they were so good in transition. If somehow, you know, you got that or you scored and made them take the ball out of bounds, their half-court execution was excellent because they ran the triangle very, very well, and the team was, you know, well-constructed to give Jerry, you know, kind of balance it a little bit. Jerry Krause has taken so many hits in this thing, but he did have a lot to do with their success. But then, you know, that was kind of the second part of the defensive challenge. And then the worst part was it got down to 5 or 6 seconds. You know, everybody in the league, when the clock's running down, yell red, or there's some code. Usually it's red from the bench. And what you normally do is put the ball in the best guy's hands and get out of his way. Well, guess what? That was the hardest thing to defend. So, I mean, you know, you're always trying to sell your teams on defense in the NBA, saying, hey, we only got to defend for 24 seconds, guys. It's not that hard. You know, let's play. It was almost a double-edged sword. If you did a good job, if you happened to, they didn't score in transition, you did a good job defending the triangle. Well, guess what? They throw the ball to Michael, and then you were, remember the first, I think it was the first segment, Sidney Moncrief, Michael was talking about his third game in the league against the Bulls, or excuse me, against the Bucks. Moncrief was one of the best defenders in the league, and he talked about when you went at him late in the clock, he would split a trap or get to the rim or split into the middle and then kick it out, and somebody would get a shot. So it was almost like a threefold defensive challenge. Take him out at fast break, defend the triangle, and then when the clock's on your back, they give the ball to the best player in the world and try and defend him. And he's unselfish. You know, on top of being the best player, he's unselfish. So if you doubled him or if you did get him in kind of a little bit of a bind. He'd find the open guy. So, no, it was no fun at all playing against. It wasn't an accident. I mean, when you win six, it's hard to do. But I always felt that as great as they were offensively, and certainly they were, and you got, you know, Steve and Pax and guys like that, that when they got open shots, forget about it. They were really, really good defensively, and that was a problem. I mean, you couldn't run offense against them, and you knew you had to score a lot of points to begin with because they were so good offensively. So they really were a complete team, and they were extremely well coached.
PJ Carlissimo joining us here, of course, and longtime NBA coach, great college coach, took Seton Hall to the Final Four, and our colleague here at ESPN. So, PJ, let's talk about the dream team, because there was clearly the matchups there. Oh, we lost him. All right. We will try to get him back. hopefully he calls back. So, Laura, let me know when he's back in the interim. I do want to talk to him about, because, Greg, you said you didn't know about that college game.
No, I had no idea that happened. When you mentioned it, I was like, what? What is
yeah,
this? And why wasn't it in the doc?
So in the original Dream Team documentary, and I want to get PJ's thoughts on that when we can get him back on the phone, they lost to a team with Bobby Hurley and Chris Webber and a bunch of the best college players. And that wasn't in the documentary yesterday, but it was in the Dream Team documentary. And I feel like that's what really grabbed their attention. Whereas, look, I think in this documentary, they were just focusing on the guys that were playing in the NBA. So I think that was just kind of the deal. But that to me is an untold story that probably should have been told. Maybe Michael didn't want to give those guys any love. But it felt like that was something that I wanted to discuss with him. So PJ's back. PJ, I was going to ask you about the Dream Team. So, you know, they talked about the matchup between, Magic and Michael kind of going at it that one time. I want to get to that in a second, but the one thing they left out of this documentary that was in the Dream Team documentary, and you were on the Dream Team staff, was when the college kids came in and beat the NBA guys. What was that scenario like?
Well, it's funny. Mike Kay and I, like Mike's one of my probably the dinosaurs. Mike Kay and Jim Boeheim are two of my closest friends, and Mike and I like to disagree, and that's something that he felt that Chuck Daly planned the whole thing, and we disagreed. I half agree with him. Let's set it up. We were practicing in San Diego, actually La Jolla. We stayed in that hotel that sits right on Torrey Pines. Practices were at UCSD. That was the first time the team came together, and Chuck had a meeting the first night, talked about what expectations were. And I can honestly say, George, you know, we've had other teams, other USA basketball teams that didn't, you know, I don't say mailed it in, but they weren't always there every time, and they knew how good they were, and they maybe didn't have the attention to detail, and sometimes it bit us. You know, we lost some competitions along the way. That team, with the exception of maybe that one practice in La Jolla, they brought it every night. It was a good time. People forget it was a good time. We had lost in '88. We didn't win the gold medal in Seoul. It was the first time the NBA represented, the NBA players were allowed to represent. And you had a lot of guys who had never been part of the Olympic experience and really wanted it and treasured it. But that practices that you're talking about, the first time we scrimmaged, there was now they call it a select team, and it's usually the best young players in the NBA come and play on the select team so that the national team, the Olympic team, like Pop's team will have next summer when they practice, they'll bring in 10 or 12 of the best young players in the league, guys that are not on the big team. And that kind of gets them, Jerry Colangelo uses the term, gets them in the pipeline. Well, in those days, it was a college team. It was Bobby Hurley, Penny Hardaway, Chris Webber, Grant Hill. I'm forgetting guys. I mean, most of them went on to be NBA All-Stars. I mean, it was a really good team, coached by George Raveling and Roy Williams. And when we would scrimmage at the end of practice, like we'd have our drills and everything, and we'd put offense or defense in, Chuck would, and then at the end, we'd bring the college guys in, and we'd scrimmage against them. So that's who we scrimmaged against for all the practices in San Diego. And I think it was the first one. We're scrimmaging, and the college guys are amped out of their minds, like really playing hard, and they're winning. You know, they're up a couple, whatever it is, late in the thing, and, you know, they're kind of going. And our guys maybe did, you know, rather, I don't want to say they cooled it, but they were trying to win, but it wasn't the same. But more importantly, and this is where Mike and I sometimes disagree, Chuck didn't, like, take a timeout and put, like, you know, Michael, put, I don't know who the best five would be, and this was the first day, but Chuck didn't play it like it was, a, you know, an NBA game, and it really mattered who won. He kind of let it play out. The guys that were on the floor, he let them play, and even if they were getting outplayed by the college guys, and the college guys won the scrimmage. And it was an interesting message. And, you know, Chuck just kind of quietly after it was over, I don't think he ever referenced. The thing that I always remembered was the miracle on ice. You know, like as good as that team was, you always kind of had, hey, you still got to go out there and play. And that was maybe the only time the entire summer, where Chuck said, hey, guys, you know, it's not enough to just show up. We got to come and we got to play. And then I think the next day when we scrimmaged the college guys, it was like a shutout for a while. It might have been like 20-2 or something like that. And, you know, lesson learned, message taken, and they dominated them the rest of the week. But it was clearly we did lose the scrimmage. I think it was the first one. And Chuck, I think, was complicit in the losing, but I don't think he thought before, because I don't know whether he would even imagine they were good enough to beat us. But clearly, as it evolved, and the college guys were, like, you know, going crazy, really playing well, and they were all psyched. And it's hard to go back in time, because you say these names, and you say, well, these guys were great players. They were young kids. I mean, if you watch that scrimmage now, that's what they were. They were young kids, and it was like, it was unbelievable for them to be even on the floor with some of our players. So they were, like, just really jacked and playing really well. And Chuck clearly let it evolve the way it did. And I think it was a great teaching point. And it was, you know, kind of typical of Chuck Daly. He was at times unconventional, but he knew how to motivate players. He knew how to handle great players. Like, not a lot of people can coach that level of player. I mean, everybody said, well, that team was going to win anyhow. Yeah, we probably were. I mean, that team was so talented. But I don't know that there's too many guys that would have done as good a job as Chuck Daly did with that roster.
PJ Carlissimo with us here, longtime NBA coach and, of course, colleague here at ESPN, was part of that Dream Team staff. Yeah, and look, I mean, he clearly caught their attention by letting that happen, which is pretty awesome. And it was awesome for those young guys to get one against them. But my understanding is the next time they played, Jordan and those guys kicked their ass.
Beyond that, it was a massacre. It was, you know, guys, just so you know, here's the deal. Boom. And just, you know, literally what we talked about before about the Bulls defense. They couldn't get the ball in bounds. They couldn't get it up the court. You know, the other thing it was reminiscent of, Georgie, was first time we played Croatia over in Barcelona, and Michael and Scotty were frothing at the mouth to deny Tony Kukoc the ball. They didn't let Tony catch it. They didn't let him bounce it. They didn't let him get off a good shot. I think he had 4 points the first time we played him. Now, to his credit, second time when we played him in the gold medal game, Tony played well. I think he had 16 or 17 points. And he's, you know, but he had no idea what was going to happen that first time. And these guys were, again, it was all related to Jerry Krause. But, I mean, they were, and they got the other guys riled up. They were like going, hey, don't let him score. I mean, it was like unbelievable even before the game started. But you had that same kind of intensity in the second time we scrimmaged the college players. And I think order was restored, let's put it that way, from the second scrimmage on.
PJ, for Magic, considering he hadn't played in a little over a year, whatever it was at that particular time, what was it like for him to just kind of, I guess, reassert himself in that basketball world? How did you observe that?
He loved it. And Magic was a player that I didn't know very well. It was funny, like the dynamics on the team. I knew some of the guys very well. You had a couple Big East players. You had guys who were playing in college when I was coaching in college. I was a college coach at that time. And it played against, or guys I knew well from the Nike experience, because we'd go on the Nike coaches trip, and some of the elite players would go with us. Charles always went with us, David, Michael. You know, they'd go on a trip and we'd golf and play poker and, you know, have a good time for 4 or 5 days. Some of them I didn't know at all. I didn't know Birdie very well. I didn't know Irvin. I didn't know Carl and John. Carl Malone and John Stockton, got to know them. Magic was like some other guys, and again, people forget it when they look back because they're used to what we have now. The best players make the Olympic team, you know, every 4 years. Sometimes guys repeat. You know, you had LeBron and KD and guys like that playing from, you know, one or two Olympics or World Cups. It wasn't like that in those days. You got one chance to play normally, and Michael and Patrick and Chris Mullin had played in 84 for Bobby Knight in Los Angeles in the 84 Olympics, and David had played in 88. In Seoul when we didn't win. But the other guys hadn't had the opportunity. And the story went that, I don't know if it was true, one of the 88 trials I was involved as a floor coach in Colorado Springs before they picked the team. But they had said that in 84, John Stockton and Charles Barkley were like among the last cuts, so they didn't get a chance to play. And then you had guys like Magic and Bird and that had never had the Olympic experience, and it was really meaningful to them. So you had Magic back playing, which was special, playing on the Dream Team with these other great, great players, and you know, having had basketball taken away from him for a while, it was really meaningful to come back. But he was like the elder state. He and Birdie were the elder statesmen, and Michael clearly deferred to them. When Chuck talked about naming a captain, I think Michael, along with Chuck, said, hey, these two guys should be the captain. Magic enjoyed the experience tremendously. But it's hard to, you kind of get an insight into it now that you see all the hubbub about Isaiah not being selected. This was a big deal for these guys to be on a U.S. Olympic team and to compete in Olympics. And there was only four guys that had had that experience. And these other great players, even though they were MVPs and NBA champions, had never been in Olympics. So it was a really special experience. So Magic enjoyed it on a lot of different levels. The friendship, I think it was the first two shows, you kind of had him talking about getting to know Michael. Because, you know it, George, as much as these guys know each other, you know, play if they're in the same conference four times a year or twice a year if they're in the other, some of them really don't know each other. And when you spend, you know, a good part of, I don't know what our thing was, I think it was about 7 weeks together, and particularly in Monte Carlo and Barcelona, you had the families involved. You had guys' wives and children or girlfriends with them. They really get to know each other well. So Magic really was looking forward to that and really treasured that. And it was funny. I that first show, you got Birdie saying that it wasn't Michael Jordan he played in that series in Boston, which Boston won, but it was God came down and dressed in yeah. Michael's outfit. Yeah. And then you had Irvin saying, well, it was no question who the best player in the league was. It was Michael Jordan. I mean, you got Larry Bird and Irvin Johnson saying he's the best player in the world and saying, like, you know, he plays on another level. I mean, it was spectacular, and I think he enjoyed it so much. Irvin, on so many different levels. And it was really good to see the way Michael deferred, if you will, in terms of, you know, that those are the guys, Larry and, you know, and Irvin are the, you know, the captains. They're the guys who speak up. But there was still no question who the best player was. And that kind of came out in those scrimmages we talked about in Monte Carlo when teams played against each other, because we had no college guys to go against there.
Right.
It's funny because we scrimmaged against the college guys in San Diego. In Portland, which everybody forgets, we had to qualify. It was a different qualification process in those days. We hadn't won in 88, which used to get you in automatically to the next one. We hadn't won the gold medal in 88, so we had to qualify. So in Portland, we never practiced. We had like six games in 8 days, so all we had were games and shoot-arounds. So we never practiced. So it wasn't until we got to Monte Carlo and we had a week of practice to get ready for Barcelona that, guess what? Guess when we scrimmage, guess who's going to scrimmage? It's, you know, our five guys in blue against our five guys in white. That was the first time they had really gone against each other, and that was the best basketball. And that was kind of when Michael, yeah, no question, he deferred to those guys and everything like that. But line up and let's keep score and see. It came to the, you know, right away you knew, hey, this guy is the best player, and he was letting even those other, you know, unbelievable talents, letting them know, hey, I'm the best one. Kevin Love had a good quote last night. I don't know what it was. You know how attuned I am to social media. I don't know whether it was Twitter or whatever the hell it was, one of those things. But it was like the alpha of all alphas was Michael or something like that. It was kind of an interesting quote. But it's true. When it came time to play and keep score and play against each other, it was always Michael's team against Magic's because John Stockton was dinged up, couldn't go every day. We really only had two point guards on the team, John Stockton and Irvin. And the third one was MJ. So when we scrimmaged every day, it was Michael's team against Magic's team. And the matchups were, you know, Patrick versus David, Karl Malone versus Charles. I mean, the wing players were Pip and Clyde Drexler and Chris Mullin. It was a joke.
Right.
You know, every matchup was incredible.
PJ, I got a minute here. Give me the best card game story you got from that trip.
Well, Charles was talking about it last night. It was kind of funny. On SVP, he asked Charles about when we used to play on the Nike trip, Charles would try and buy the pot. Charles had a bunch of coaches, and we were doing okay, but nobody was making the money that he was playing. And Charles is not a terrible poker player. And but he, you know, we know once a game, he would like put like, there was no table stakes. You put in whatever you want. He'd say $5,000 and try and buy the pot. He claimed Michael tried to do that with those guys all the time because they played literally every day. But the thing I learned then as a college coach, which I didn't appreciate and saw many, many times during my NBA years, in the NBA, when they play, even on the plane, the money's in their hand. It's cash in the hand. There's no chips. There's no, hey, I'm good for it. You want to make a bid, you put the cash on the table. The cash they were putting on the table had a lot more zeros and a lot more. it was unbelievable, like when they would raise. But, I mean, it was in their hand. Usually they'd be standing there and the money would be in their left hand. And that was how the game was played. That was pretty much the rule in the NBA.
That's funny.
The thing is chips or I'm good for it, like put it in. It was the green went on the table. And fortunately, I wasn't a part of those games.
Well, you know what? Charles is coming on at 11:30 in about an hour, and I'm going to tell him, why'd you try to steal all the coaches' money, Charles? Why were you trying to bully them?
Nike coaches trip, he did the same thing that he accused Michael of doing on the Olympic trip.
I will bring that up to him.
The pots on the Nike coaches trip.
I'll bring that up to him. PJ, you're the best. Thanks for joining us, man. Stay safe, stay healthy.
All right, George, great being with you.
Take care, brother. There he is, PJ Carlesimo joining us here. We're going to ask Charles about that in an hour. Real quick, Michael Cooper's coming up in 4 minutes, so stick around for that. We'll talk to Coop about his days with Magic and playing against those Bulls teams in the finals. Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. All our guests appear via the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line, and this segment brought to us by our friends as well at My Computer Career, training for a better life. If you miss any one of our interviews, like we just had with PJ Carlesimo, or with Michael Cooper, who's coming up, if you have to run for some reason, or Charles Barkley. Maybe you're not going to be around at 11:30. You can check out our interview on demand section on the Sedano Show podcast on the ESPN app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Podcasts, wherever you find your podcasts. It's brought to you by Capital One. Why settle for average? With Capital One, you can open a savings account with a rate 5 times higher than the national average. Welcome to Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, NA member FDIC. So Michael Cooper joins us here now. Of course, Laker great joining us here. Coop, is everyone okay? Healthy, safe, and sound?
Doing good this way, man. How you doing, George? Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely, sir. We are good. We're glad to have you on. We are happy that you took the time to hang out with us and glad that everyone is healthy, safe, and sound with you. So let me ask you this. As you've been kind of observing, like everyone else, right, appointment viewing with this Michael Jordan Bulls documentary, what was it like for you and the Lakers, kind of when you were facing him on the come up, even before you guys faced him in the finals?
George, you actually were saying that like we were scared of him. No, we weren't scared of Jordan. I think we were the team.
No, I'm not saying that. Not at all. Not at all.
Much respect to Michael Jordan as a player, but you got to remember, as we were going through those 80s and we were dealing with the Celtics and the Pistons and the 76ers, Jordan was building his team slowly as well as defining himself as a great player. And once all those teams exhausted the fight and got it out of us, and then the 90s came, that's when he took off as they built their team around. But you know what? That's a fantastic ball club they had. I think it was something, a learning lesson that they took from us and the Celtics and the other players, is that it takes more than one player to win a championship. So they had to build that by Dennis Rodman and the people that they eventually got to help build that team to where it is, that dynasty type of team that you're seeing now.
It is interesting, though, that for the most part, you know, whether it was him or the Pistons or your battles with the Celtics, that you had to go through somebody, right? Like, somebody was always going to be in your way, and you had to overcome that. Like, even for you guys, yes, I mean, Magic won right away, right, as a rookie playing center. But you guys, it took you a while to get Boston, right? And that was a big deal to you guys to be able to get one of those wins against Boston.
Oh, for sure. And being from Los Angeles, a true Los Angeles person, I've watched over the years how the Lakers with Jerry West and Wilt and Elgin could never get over that hump. But you know what? Before we got to Boston, we had to go through it. You got to remember in 79, the late, great Dennis Johnson, the Gus Williams, the Jack Sigma, that Seattle Supersonics team. That was a tough team to get over. And it took us to a, you know, really hard game, seven-game series, so that we can get the field. But, you know, we eventually got there. We played the 76ers the first time and was able to beat them. And at that time, we really didn't know what we were doing. We were just trying to define ourselves as what type of team we were going to be. And it turned out to be Showtime, but there was a way that Showtime had to be played, and we had to play in a fast break style, and Magic was the choreographer of all that. So, yes, by the time we got to beating the 76ers and eventually the Boston Celtics, we had to do our work out west, and there was a lot of great teams out here that we had to go through.
Michael Cooper joining us here. Coop, how did Showtime evolve? For the young folks out there listening and need a little education on the Showtime Lakers, like, clearly Pat took over, but it was because of Magic, I would imagine, and just the ability that you guys had yourself and all these different players on the wing to get up and down. But how did that evolve into the way you guys played?
Well, first of all, you know, the two people you spoke about, Pat and Magic, were very, very instrumental in that. But you got to go back to the head of it, and that was the late, great Dr. Buss, our owner. He wanted to bring an entertaining type of game to Los Angeles and with the Los Angeles Lakers and the Laker girls. He wanted the stars to, you know, they entertain us when we go to the movies. They entertain us when we go to musicals and things like that. So he wanted an opportunity to entertain them, that they can come and sit down and watch and relax and be entertained. So Dr. Buss's vision for the Lakers was the first significant stepping stone of Showtime. And then before that happened, you got Jerry West was the owner, head coach of the team when I got with the Lakers in 78, 79. And then he took his rightful seat and went in to be the GM. And the GM had to pick the right players. And obviously Jerry and Dr. Buss picking Magic Johnson. So now you bring it from the stands, from the building to the stands to the general manager. Now you take it to the court, and the right pieces had to be put together there. Obviously, Magic Johnson was the perfect fit because you already had Kareem, myself, you had Norm Nixon, you had Jamal Wilkes, those pieces added. So now Jerry West brings in a Bob McAdoo. He brings in and gets a Byron Scott. He brings in James Worthy. So the pieces were being put together to develop Showtime. What was Showtime? Showtime was an entertaining style of basketball. Back east, you had the what they call the black, blue and bruise butters and all that, work ethic type of basketball that the Celtics came, blue collar, where they just played and they kind of just slowly wore you down. Well, we wanted to run you down and wear you down that way. So Magic, again, was orchestrating that by having the flamboyancy and the style of play that he has. Kareem had the sky hook, and then myself, Byron Scott, Kurt Rambis, you had a lot of entities that went on to making Showtime. And once we got it into gear, man, we never let up, and we stayed on top of people.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Michael Cooper joining us here. Before I get to the Bulls, that the team you faced in the finals in the 91 season, let's finish off the Celtics. Just how would you best describe the hatred that there was between you and that group when you guys were facing off in all those finals?
Well, for me, it goes, like I said, way back to the 60s, being born here and watching how the Celtics would always beat them, and didn't know that I would be an integral part in that whole dynamic of Boston Celtic Laker basketball, and have an opportunity to play for my hometown team, which is a rarity for anybody. And so we finally get to the Celtics, and again, that brewing or that animosity or that rivalry we have right there, you remember, it goes back to college when Larry Bird was at Indiana State, Magic at Michigan State. So it started there, and it just bled right over into the NBA, which was great. It was fantastic the way the basketball gods let this happen, where Magic was on the West Coast and Larry's on the East, and now you had it. And the fun part about that is you have to realize that that rivalry never would have been fun, only like, you know, you keep it on the West. That's something that has to develop through the course of the season. And you finally, you get to play the last, the most significant and important basketball game to see who's going to be a champion against those two players, against our two teams. So, you know, it took some hard work, you know, to get there. In 1980, we beat the Sixers, and then Celtics beat, and then we finally meet each other in 84. And it was always a thing of where, you know, I talk now with Cedric Maxwell, ML Carr, some of the guys that I still hate to this day, and I'm not even getting to the other guys I hate, like Bill Laimbeer and some of the others, but ML Carr and him waving his towel and Cedric Maxwell with his mouth running all the time. But then you had the cornerstones of that team in Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, and Parrish, really the toughest big front line that you could ever have, and that will go against any three people in the NBA today, no matter what era you played in. But to get past that, we had to learn how to play tough basketball. The Celtics' way to beat us was to slow us down. And in order for us to beat them, we had to speed the game up. So there was a stalemate going on. And whoever initiated that first game and the way you played, whether it be at home or away, that was, you're going to have a better chance to win. So those are some fantastic basketball. You know, you hate that what's going on now, the quarantine where we're in, and we're hoping that everybody is being safe about this. But it's given us a good chance. I've never really watched us that much, is to see the NBA basketball and ESPN Classics. We were good.
Yeah, you were good. You guys were pretty good, Coop. Michael Cooper joining us here. You know, real quick, one last thing on that rivalry with you and the Celtics. Riley once told me a story about shenanigans going on when you guys would play in Boston, as far as the way they treat your locker room. Sometimes no heat, sometimes no hot water. What was that like when they would play those kind of shenanigans with you?
Oh, it was terrible. But those are the things that I had heard before. You know, way back in the day when you talked to former players, when I first got with the team, the Lou Hudson, Ron Boone, how Boston was just terrible. And, I mean, it was true. You know, I remember we playing them in 84, and it was boiling hot in Boston. We get there, and our bus breaks down, and we have to take cabs, and we're caught under the bridge, under the tunnel. And we finally get there, and we get ready for the game, and it's like 85, 90 degrees game day. We go into our locker room. All the windows are closed, and the heater's turned up to 90 degrees. So we're sweating profusely before we even go out for shoot-around. Then we play them during the season, and it's a big game because, again, you want to establish bragging rights. You know, we see them one time, and they see us one, two times during the season, one home and one away. We go there, and it's 20 degrees in Boston. We get to the game. We go into the locker room. All our windows are open, and the air conditioner is turned up all the way high. So those things that they felt that they needed to do to get that edge, and that's how Red Auerbach played it. But those were fun. And you know what? You think of it now, and at the time, we were so boiling mad, which actually worked for us because we went out with some kind of vengeance and some venom to play the game.
Yeah.
Most of the time we won, most of the time we lost. But those are the fun parts that you miss about basketball. But that's Boston did everything they could to beat us because they knew if we turned our games into track meets, we were going to leave them in the dust.
No doubt. And you certainly did that when you were facing them the second time. Michael Cooper with us here. Coop, I heard you're doing a podcast called the Showtime Podcast. You just had Kareem on. What's that like?
Oh, it's been wonderful. You know, through these tough times we're going through, what better way than Michael Cooper can express himself other than not trying to be that skinny guy to be a tough guy. Now I get to use my mouth a little bit more. I wasn't trash talking today, but you know what? I've kind of turned into one now, Joe. But it's Showtime with Coop Podcast, and what I like to call it is called Insightful BS by Legend. So when I talk to some of my friends and I get a chance, you know, like you said, I sat down and had an interview with Kareem. I was able to get some things out of Cap that nobody knew. We know a lot about our superstars and stuff like that, but when you play with them and you kind of like live with them like we did with Magic and Scott and Worthy, and some of those guys are going to be my guests too in the future, you get to hear a little bit more about just the greatness that you saw on the court. I'm getting them to tell you some things off the court.
There he is, Michael Cooper, the Showtime Podcast with Coop. Make sure you download it, subscribe to it. He just had Kareem on. Check it out. Coop, you're the best, man. Stay healthy, stay safe, you and your family, and thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. And listen to us today because we got Lisa Leslie, one of the greatest female women to ever play this game, who I said could play in the NBA and probably lock Cedric Maxwell up. We're dropping her spot today.
All right, Coop. We'll check it out. Thank you. All right, take care. There he is, Michael Cooper. Hey, don't forget, Charles Barkley's coming up at 11:30. But coming up next, we've got some news on the NBA and some sad news in the NFL world. We'll get to all that next.